focused on the thought of the Ramchal in Masilas Yesharim, and we took the introduction and most of the first section dealing with Zehirus as an example of that thought, and tried to develop some of the patterns of this work, the thinking behind this work, and to show how the Pratim really are consistent with the focus that the Ramchal wants to project as the basis for Avodas Hashem. And a little bit here and there, we made reference to the contrasting views, especially in the Lithuanian, what's known as the Lithuanian world, tried to show how, in some cases, the Rishonim as well, and Chazal, had different perspectives on some of the issues, but that especially the the thought of the world of Lithuania represented a sharp contrast in many respects to the thinking of the Ramchal. And as we were developing more and more the patterns inside the Ramchal, we never got a chance really to get back to the contrast. I think I mentioned one aspect of it, the use of the two Mishnayos in Avos, but I wanted to take at least today to develop the other side of it and to take some readings from Isha Halacha, which I think magnificently capture the contrasting view. So before we speak about the contrasting view, let me recap just very quickly what it is that we were underscoring about the Ramchal's Mesilas Yesharim. So the Ramchal already in the Hakdama, and as I say consistently throughout, develops the idea that basically this world, again, focused on the Mishnah in Avos, but projecting it much further than anyone else, did, that this world is merely a gateway for the world to come. And he basically depicts a world which is a trap in which there are all sorts of potential disastrous outcomes for people. And someone who's not vigilant, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, right, is likely to be derailed from his goal of being an Ovid Hashem. The purpose of the Torah, as he understands it, is to neutralize those distractions and even worse, those traps, and to provide, an enlightened approach for people to kind of rack up enough schar, avoid enough onesh, so that they will be worthy of the real purpose of life, which is a schar to Olam Haba. In that sense, the idea that Olam Hazeh is merely a gateway and that Olam Haba is the focus is a very central motif in his work. So the Yetzer Hara and all of the potential hazards and pitfalls, which are a standard part of classical Chazal, we tried to show last year that they are accentuated even more so in the work of the Mesilas Yesharim. And the positive aspects of this world are relegated to the mechanism of neutralizing those hazards, let's say, and providing a safe gateway to the real focus, which is Chaye Olam Haba. And that's really just in a nutshell. There are many beautiful ideas along the way. We only did the first four to five chapters. We focused on the first of the Brice of Rabbi Pinchas Ben Yair, and then the Kinyan of Zehirus. But I think it was obvious that for Ramchal, Torah and mitzvos are a means or a mechanism to achieve the end that I just described. And even to the point where he has, Kavata Itam La Torah is not so much the learning per se, it's again the learning which is able to offset Tirda, which is distraction, is a big mikshal for people who get to, derailed, as I say, from that focus of achieving skar v'onesh, which will lead them to chai olam haba. This is true in his assessment of mitzvos and what it is that you're supposed to take away from the story of the Avos. We didn't discuss that one so much in detail, but the idea of Schar Ba'onesh and Midas Hadin, the Ramchal basically puts some Midas HaChesed on the defensive in the fourth and fifth chapter of the beginning of the book, because again, for him, being done Kechut HaSa'ara, even the great figures, is all critical. All that is part of neutralizing any kind of relaxation or laxity or distraction, that would become an obstacle for achieving the goal. So this is the worldview that the Ramchal is projecting, and I'd say there are a lot of because of that different emphasis, or because of that consistent emphasis, he's also able to bring out and to illuminate very interesting perspectives on some of the basic categories of Torah and of Avodah. You say Talmud Torah and Schar Va'Onesh and Ma'is Avos Simon Labanim, etc. And there's tremendously rich material here, and some of the formulations are very inspiring. And I'd say we only really touched the first chapter, the chapter or the different aspects of Zahirus. As he goes forward, discussing this Rizus and everything else, their patterns remain consistent. Maybe we'll do some of them going forward. But and of course, there are further insights on all sorts of other parts of the Halacha and Avodas Hashem. But the basic structure and the basic themes are as I've described them. So I wanted to spend today, and maybe next week also, just contrasting that with the worldview that I think reflects the world of the Gra and Chaim Mivalajan, particularly as expressed in Nefesh HaChaim, and to highlight it through the writings of the Ish Halacha, which, while very sophisticated, I think is mostly just a very remarkable but very accurate description of the worldview of Lita, relating to the same kind of questions, but providing a very different model. Okay, so the structure of Ish Halacha, at least in the beginning, is, and I'll read it from the English, translation, because I think most people have that and it's more accessible. This was written, of course, in Hebrew in the 1940s, and translated, I think, in the, I'll find out exactly, 1980 or so, or 83. The translation is an excellent and an accurate translation. So while you always gain from reading the original, and the Rav's command of sophisticated Hebrew is itself something that is very impressive, the ability to articulate, and it wasn't his first spoken language, clearly, is an amazing thing. So there, any translation is always less ideal than the original. But having said that, the translation really is an excellent job, and it was done in conjunction with him as well. So we're going to read from that. So the structure of Ish Halacha, particularly in the beginning, is to contrast three archetypes. It's what he calls homo religiosus, or religious man, cognitive man, and the one which draws from and integrates the best of both of those worlds, which of course is the Ish Halacha, or halachic man. So to a great extent, although the Mesilas Yesharim is not mentioned at all, I'm not suggesting that this was an intent, that the Ish Halacha was structured as a refutation or a response particularly to Mesilas Yesharim. As I say, the issues that are dealt with in Mesilas Yesharim are issues that are drawn from classical Midrashim and Chazals, etc. What we tried to show in Mesilas Yesharim is that if you concentrate them in a certain way, right, and you put them together, right, then they're usually more than just quotation of sources, because their selectivity of sources and the juxtaposition and the the cumulative patterns go well beyond the quotation of sources, and especially when there are multiple perspectives on a topic and you choose selectively one over the other. So that's making a statement, and that brings focus to a work. So I don't think that the Ish Halacha is necessarily intended to be a response to Mesilas Yesharim. It's very possible that it's just a perspective, which of course also highlights a contrast to other Jewish thinkers and Midrashim, etc. But it just happens to work out very well, and it's also possible. Mesilas Yesharim is obviously one of the most well-known works. If you ask somebody, to pick a classical work of Musar, the first thing that will come trippingly off their tongues is Mesilas Yesharim, which is a little bit ironic. Also, a year ago when we began the study, right? So I did a couple of one and a half. Of the Shiurim, discussing the background of the Ramchal and what a controversial figure he was. The idea that he would be seen as the classical formulator of Musar in his day, would have been more than ironic, because he was, as I say, a very controversial figure. Mesilas Yesharim is not necessarily typical of the rest of his works. In any case, it's a very well-known work, and certainly this question of how you focus on this world and the world to come is objectively, these are objectively categories which any Machshava work would want to relate to. But I think very specifically when you juxtapose Nefesh HaChayim, some of the known positions and statements of the Gra and Ish HaLacha with Mesilas Yesharim, it just makes for a very interesting study. So the Rav, in the beginning of Ish HaLacha, basically portrays these three archetypes. The Ish HaLacha is the integration in some sense, but not an absolute equal integration of cognitive man and of religious man. Here on page 13, towards the beginning of the book, he lays out the structure, and it's fascinating if you go through it. He's not always consistent in these characterizations. The categories are a little bit more fluid than you would expect. That's typical in the Rav's writings and thinking. But maybe we'll get back to that a little bit later on. So he portrays it in the following way. This characteristic attitude of homo religiosus toward existence directly entails the following conclusion. Homo religiosus, means a religious man, does not acknowledge any ontic monism. Reality for him is not uniform, monochromatic, but rather pluralistic and multilayered. Ontic pluralism is the very foundation of the worldview of homo religiosus. When he approaches the world in order to cognize and evaluate it, he attempts to find in this concrete and physical world the traces of higher worlds, all of which are wholly good and eternal. He seeks to discover the source of plenitude and being and of the fullness of cosmos and supernal ontic realms that are pristine and pure. This transcendent approach to reality constitutes a primary feature of the profile of the man of God. Homo religiosus is dissatisfied and unhappy with this world. He searches for an existence that is above empirical reality. The world is a pale image of another world. In other words, again, homo religiosus is somebody who, again, in this first initial, a little bit more extreme formulation, is somebody who is dissatisfied with or doesn't find religious significance in Olam Hazeh, right, but somebody who is looking for something beyond, something more transcendent. Cognitive man, on the other hand, is not concerned at all with a reality that extends outside the realm of lawfulness and has no relationship with any mode of being that is beyond empirical reality and scientific understanding. For the law is his goal, and lawfulness always and only to be found within a context of concreteness. In his Critique of Pure Reason, Kant establishes the bounds of space and time as limits of comprehension. Cognitive man pays no attention to and is wholly uninterested in a world that is above the rule of empirical reality. The object with which he is concerned is completely hemmed in by the total physical and psychical reality. In other words, again, you have these two competing worldviews, and they are, in the first blush at least, the first presentation, mutually exclusive. Homo religiosus passes beyond the realm of concreteness and reality, set within the frame of scientific experience, and enters into a higher realm. Basically, if you had to simply characterize the description here, in other words, so religious man is focused on beyond this world, right? He's not his interest, his object is not the concrete physical world at all. He sees that as something which is an obstacle, blocking, you know, the ultimate and preferred, not even preferred, the only meaningful religious goal. Whereas a scientific man or cognitive man is somebody who has no ambitions right beyond, you know, what his senses experience. And his world is the physical, the concrete world. However, it's particularly fascinating that I say there's a certain fluidity in these passages. And I think of that as consistent in the Rav's writings and in his thinkings. Again, I'm jumping around, not going in order, but it's interesting that earlier, on page 7, almost in the very beginning of the work, like 3 or 4 pages in, so the characterization of homo religiosus, or a religious man, is one which does not completely negate or reject olam hazeh, physical world, or its laws, but rather is focused on what it implies about that which is beyond and transcendent. The focus of religious man is to revel in the mysterious, right? What is implied by the physical world, something which is intolerable, to cognitive man. But by no means, right, is religious man completely uninterested in or unsatisfied by the physical and the concrete world. And this, I think, already provides a glimpse, you know, into, you know, certainly the nature of the integration that is going to apply to the ideal middle character, the halachic man. If even homo religiosus, right, sees in the present world, you know, potential, just that he has to, you know, have a highly acute, you know, sense, you know, of what it is that he can perceive and what it is that he can cull from this world, then kal v'chomer, the integration of the two, is going to accentuate the potential of olam hazeh. So this passage is a passage on page 7, I think I just mentioned, where he says that, for while cognitive man discharges his obligation by establishing the reign of a causal structure of lawfulness in nature, homo religiosus is not satisfied with the perfection of the world under the dominion of the law. For to him, the concept of lawfulness is in itself the deepest of mysteries. Cognition, according to the worldview of the man of God, consists in the discovery of the wondrous and miraculous quality of the very laws of nature themselves. Again, that's not a negation of nature and the real world, or the physical world, right? It's just a different perspective, a greater ambition, right, in unraveling, right, the mysteries of this world and what they reflect. The mystery of the world is to be encountered precisely in the understanding of the functional relationship, in effect, between the phenomena of this world. Every clarification of a phenomenon brings in its wake new enigmas. Homo religiosus sees the entire ordered world, the entire creation which is delineated and bound by the law, as a cryptic text whose content cannot be deciphered, as a conundrum that the most resourceful of men cannot solve. The riddle of riddles is the very nature of law itself, meaning the law of universe, nature. In a word, the cognitive act of homo religiosus is one of concealment and hiding. Now again, if you only had the later passage on page 13, you'd get the impression that these are mutually exclusive perspectives. This is an olam hazeh versus a, you know, probably olam haba, or at least the olam of the Rabbonu Shel Olam, transcendence, mutually exclusive categories. But as you can see, even earlier, the you know, the tone has been established that even religious man has much to discover and much meaning to uncover in this world. And that pattern of, you know, the overlap, you know, between the two, and more a question of interpreting, you know, the proper focus, extracting the proper value within the phenomena of this world, right, is the one of the chidushim even in the structuring of the two extremes, before we even get to the question of the ideal of Ish Halakha. So just to highlight it again, even when he's downplaying the physical world in his formulation of religious man, right, you have another passage, it's more that man doesn't want to be limited to the physical world. Not that he is seeking to extricate himself from the bonds of the existence of this world. And that again is highlighted in a passage here on page 15. The ladder of ethical perfection, like the biblical ladder of Jacob, is set fast upon the earth, upon the ground of concrete reality, and the top of it reaches unto the very heavens. Again, the mashal of the Sulam Mutzav Arza, Barosha Magia Shamaima, right, is not a rejection of the foundation of the ladder. Right? It just means that it's not limited, right? It stretches from one to the other. That's the symbol. And the goal ultimately, right, is to ascend the rungs of the ladder, but the foundation remains critical. The ethical and religious ideal of homo religiosus is the extrication of his existence from the bonds of this world, from the iron chains of empirical reality, its laws and judgments, its elevation up to the level of being a higher man in a world that is wholly good and wholly eternal. The aim of religion is to liberate those who are bound in fetters and irons, those who dwell in darkness and gloom, the king held captive in tresses, Shirashir, and crown them all with the royal crown of a supernal transcendental existence emanating from holy eternal realms. So even this statement, again, which seems to be closer to a rejection of Olam Hazeh, or to see Olam Hazeh as a means to an end, but if you understand the mashal very carefully, is actually consistent with the passage I read on page 7, right? Not a rejection of, but a different focus, quite a different focus than cognitive man. And while the Rav argues that sometimes this will express itself in an ascetic tendency, right? Because if your focus is to ascend the rungs and you're dissatisfied with the limitations of the physical world, so then turning your back on physical pleasure, right, is one way to express that. But at the same time, in the very next page, right, he tells us that life-affirming or physical affirmation of life and the ascetic tendency are merely two different tactics, as both strive for an exalted, refined, and purified existence. Again, for Mesil Sisharim, just to highlight the contrast, right, the ascetic life is clearly the ideal, and you know, basically all physical pleasure constitutes a concession. That's not the perspective even of homo religiosus, never mind the Ish Halakha, which is the point I'm trying to make, in the Rav's thinking. From a philosophical perspective, the difference between the approach, this is on page 16, of self-affliction and that of affirmation of reality is purely an ethical, practical one, rooted in the act of evaluating earthly life as a means for the realization of the goal. From an ontological standpoint, and from the perspective of the ethical ideal, the two are similar. Again, this is within, right, the extreme of religious man. That's why I'm darshaning up that part of it. Both proceed from the same theoretical perspective. Both relate to a multi-layered existence. Both acknowledge an ontic and ontological pluralism, right? And both see the striving for a higher form of existence, the symbol of ethical perfection. In other words, whether you focus on an ascetic, self-abnegation, denial, right, rejection of that aspect or that dimension of physical life, whether you embrace that physicality, not a hedonistic lifestyle, but a lifestyle consistent with, material life. Even to the religious man, these both relate to multi-layered existence, both reflect ontological pluralism, right? Basically, it's a choice, it's a tactic based on your own temperament or maybe different stages of exploring different aspects of spiritual life. The entire opposition between a doctrine of asceticism and a doctrine that affirms and rejoices in life's pleasure centers on the practical utilitarian stance to be adopted and pertains to the means bring about the realization of the ethical ideal. The former states that the negation of life raises man to an elevated level at the very heights of true existence, while the latter disagrees, and of the opinion that only through accepting the yoke of the dominion of empirical reality may we hope to merit a more exalted existence. In other words, it's a machlokus in, what, metzius, I don't know, or temperament, you know, will dictate, but basically it's more of a technical, the aesthetic, or the ascetic, or the, you know, pleasurable or physical life, right, are just two sides of the same coin. That's very remarkable. That's almost a complete rejection, right, of pure asceticism as a matter of principle. And of course that goes, never mind, does that constitute a rejection of Mesilas Yesharim, the emphasis of Mesilas Yesharim, or the emphasis in his scheme, but of course it runs contrary to some views in Chazal as well. As we know, especially some medieval views among the Rishonim, where the question of, you know, body-soul dichotomy, you know, where chomer, materialism, is associated as inherent evil, or at least necessary evil in some cases, right? The Rav's perspective, which I think is more consistent with real Chazal, meaning Medrash and the Gemara mostly, sees it in a much more nuanced way. For the Rav, therefore, even religious man is not only capable of extracting or thriving, even as he acknowledges, recognizes the potential of the physical world, but it's important also for him to be rational and even rooted very much in the concreteness of this world. And again, this is a, you know, downplaying certainly of the Traklin, idea. When you get to the Ish Halacha, who is the ideal, you know, representing the best integration of both of these extremes, so understandably, it's going to be tilted because, as I've tried to show from reading a little bit here and there and out of order, right, if a religious man, right, is already someone who has a certain sympathy, right, who, you know, finds the real world conducive, you know, to his goal and his enterprise, then the more balanced and nuanced Isha Halacha is certainly going to be somebody who can not only thrive in this world, but can thrive in this world by embracing or celebrating, right, the physical aspects of it as well. And that's why when he makes the transition, halachic man differs in this worldview from the universal homo religiosus. He resembles in various ways cognitive man, yet he differs in many respects from him as well. Halachic man's approach to reality is at the outset devoid of any element of transcendence. Now, if anything, the initial formulation on Ish Halacha, I think, you know, we find almost like the parallel opposite in the presentation. I don't know how much of this is conscious or not. Again, I'm reading it and analyzing it in my own way. But again, with, you know, the two categories, the two extremes, so, you know, you expect extremes, and then, you know, as you pursue it, it appears, you know, that the gap between, you know, is not as great. And with respect to the, you know, integrated ideal, you know, Ish Halacha, so you would expect something a little bit more, you know, of a compromise, let's say, between the two. Instead, at least initially, what you get is something which is very tilted to the, you know, it's the religious cognitive man, which is what it's supposed to be, but the approach or the attitude towards physical existence and the potential inherent in physical existence isn't characterized by the kind of ambivalence, let's say, that you might expect, you know, from someone who's trying to balance these two things. On the contrary, what you really get is an embrace of the spiritual potential. It's the greater vision of the Ish Halacha to be able, right, to you know, to accomplish, to be motivated, you know, as much if not more than religious man, you know, for spiritual ends, and yet have greater vision so that he can apprehend and accomplish that goal, right, in the physical world, without any kind of ambivalence either. And that's really a striking thing, which really characterizes this approach. So again, when you first, you know, encounter the description of the Ish HaLacha, and again, I'm sure there's a certain, you know, literary, dramatic dimension here as well, because when you first read it, you're a little bit surprised. Halachic man's approach to reality is at the outset devoid of any element of transcendence. Right? Out of context, that's a very shocking statement, right? And it appears that, you know, this isn't the balance. You know, he's very much in the camp of cognitive man. Even when we read that cognitive man is not interested in transcendence, that seems a bit extreme. But certainly the Ish HaLacha, whose motivation is purely spiritual, purely religious, that he should not be interested in transcendence. So of course, again, there's a certain dramatic effect. It certainly caught our eye. This is something unusual. As we read on, and you know, we encounter, you know, the reformulations of it, and the applications of it, you know, it obviously is intended to be and is much more subtle and much more, you know, nuanced. Of course, halachic man is interested in transcendence. He's just not interested in, you know, a kind of crude transcendence. He's able to accomplish his transcendence, you know, within the Dalet Amos of halacha that, you know, that is provided for him. So again, you have to, you know, kind of withhold judgment. So withholding judgment allows us, you know, to appreciate the richer, you know, portrait and more accurate portrait. At the same time, in addition to dramatic literary effect, I think even substantively, the formulation intends and accomplishes that we should understand that this isn't a compromise, right? Certainly not a concession, you know, a little bit of this and a little bit of that, the best of this and the best of that, but that halachic man is intended to be an archetype, right, who stands on his own, right? He's somebody who is sui generis. Is he really somebody who, you know, he may take some characteristics of one and of the other, right? But, you know, he's more than the sum of his parts, and he's a birya, you know, bifnei atzmo. And that birya bifnei atzmo is not compromising. He has a very integrated worldview. So what we mean by devoid of element of transcendence, you know, I'd say becomes clear in the continuation. Indeed, his entire attitude to the world stands out by virtue of its originality and uniqueness, which is basically what I just said. Right. It's not he's, you know, gnashing a little bit from one and from the other, but his combination, right, is a refashioning of both. All frames of reference constructed by the philosophers and psychologists of religion for explaining the varieties of religious experience cannot accommodate halachic man as far as his reaction to empirical reality is concerned. That's a very big statement, right? But it accounts for, right, what otherwise sounds like a tilting in one direction. So what the Rav does is he seemingly tilts in a startling way, right? And then to neutralize it, he's basically telling, it doesn't mean what you think it means. Right? What it really means is that, you know, if you apply halacha to the physical world, right, then what we mean by, you know, living a meaningful life in the physical world just has a totally different understanding. And it's a different experience, a different category. So I think that's why, you know, first we get the sentence and then we get this idea, these sentences that follow about how unique this is, how it's, you know, never been described this way in all of the literature of religious philosophy. Halachic man studies reality not because he is motivated by plain curiosity, the way theoretical or cognitive man is, nor is he driven to explore the world by any fear of being or anxiety of non-being, we'll stop in 1 minute, nor for that matter does halachic man orient himself to the world in terms of a nebulous feeling of absolute dependence or yearning for the redemption of man, or visions of a great revealed ethical ideal. In other words, Olam Haba, Geula. Now, certainly, Chas v'Shalom, we're not denying that these are all very critical aspects of Yahadus. But the point is, that's the raison d'etre of man and of the world of Torah and Halacha, or those are dimensions, right, which are part of that, but which flow from, right, a more ambitious, you know, worldview of living a certain kind of meaningful life, of growing as an Oved Hashem. Doesn't mean you have less tzipisa liyeshua, right? It's not less, you know, b'chol yom achaka lo sheyavo, but, you know, that's different than the people who, you know, we want Mashiach now, you know, singers, you know, who, you know, are placing kind of a different, you know, emphasis on it. We don't want it less, but, right, it's part of a, you know, more profound and more multi-layered and enriched religious life. And that's really what's being stated here. Halachic man orients himself to reality through a priori images of the world, which he bears in the deep recesses of his personality. And of course, it's the deep recesses of his personality are a function of the Torah that he studies. We may, if we so desire, call this a cognitive normative approach, meaning based on Talmud Torah, the internalization of values, and of course, Shmiras HaMitzvos. So these aren't just things that we do externally. They're certainly not intended to neutralize our distraction, you know, simply as an act of Zahirus, right? Or as, you know, building up a schar, you know, v'onesh resume, you know, so that we can, you know, traverse from the Traklin into the, you know, into the Olam Haba. We want that too. That's a result, but that isn't the cause. The cause of life, or the purpose of life, is not to get Olam Haba. The purpose of life is to live, right, on a certain level, to achieve, to develop, right, to become a religious persona. That's also measured by the ticket, you know, to the next world, and that's Schar Bionish. But Schar V'Onesh, as I say, is a shiur, and Schar V'Onesh is a consequence in this worldview. It isn't the motivation or the purpose. But it is not to be identified with the cognitive and ethical orientation of which philosophers, the cognitive men, par excellence, speak. I'm going to stop here. But we'll continue just a little bit more, at least next week, to develop this idea and see some of the very sharp contrasts to some of the things that we've been discussing. Thank you.